From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 541, Self-Driving Cars with guest Mark Manassi, recorded Monday, June 26th, 2017. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. And by request, after entirely too long, which is to say several months, I have back Mr. Mark Manassi, who I'm really not going to introduce any more than that, because your old bio, while lovely and entertaining, is lengthy, like most of your discussions, really. And life is different for you now.
You mean fact-filled and complete, as opposed to this in the shallow stuff about keep it all to 15 words or less.
Well, you know, 145 characters, right? Like, if he doesn't make a tweet, why is it important?
If it's good enough for the president. I couldn't do that without the laugh.
Nice. Most days I really like being Canadian, but these days it's very easy to be smug about being a Canadian, let me tell you.
Well, you know, at least my president's old enough to drink in a bar, for God's sake.
Yeah, no, Justin's awfully young. Awfully young.
I liked his dad.
Yeah, you know, people don't remember him.
I'm about to turn 60, so this will give you this perspective.
Yep.
Was that, you know, in America, you get a new president about every 4 years, mm-hmm. something like that. And even though I'm 8 or 12 or 15, I'm not that concerned about politics, although I did spend a wonderful summer listening to the Watergate hearings. That was one of the best summers. There's no drama that could ever have been done, because there are moments where Sam Irvin's just plodding on and plodding on about this or that or the other thing, and they'll have just one more witness at the end of the day. A guy named Gut Butterfield says, "So what do you do?" "I'm in the White House. I'm an IT guy." You know, that's, I didn't say that. He's the AV guy. "What do you do?" "Oh, you know, I keep track of all the recordings in the White House." Sir, what did you say? And that was the beginning of things getting even better. So I've been looking forward to that. I'm really hoping that we might have another summer where we'll have something like that. But I guess we're just going to see.
Yeah.
And anyway, so all this time, though, Canada's got the same guy. It seemed to me like Trudeau was PM for like 1,000 years.
It was all 15 and a half years, which is a long time.
Okay. I was guessing 15.
Yeah.
And then I'm, you know, an undergraduate and experimenting with THC-related drugs. And here we got our guys clamping down. And Trudeau's like, "We should make it legal up here." Yes, we love that guy.
Yeah, well, it's one thing when a province or a state wants to legalize pot. But when you have the federals talking about it, it's a whole other can of worms.
Well, it's easy. You've only got 15 people up there. So it's not
like— Both of us all agree. We're all named Bob. Another big thing here in Vancouver, because we're dealing with the fentanyl crisis, and we've always had the opioid crisis, right? This is the highway through which heroin flows, and people die all the time. So we have, many, many years ago, we set up this thing, place called the Safe Injection Site, because we're also a nexus for the hepatitis C. The original AIDS patient supposedly died in Vancouver. And so it's always been a problem here. And so the Safe Injection Sites are really about just providing clean needles and support, like just taking away the criminal element of addiction. But in order to make that work, the inside of that building was outside of Canada. It was extraterritorial.
Hmm.
And the government for many years required that organization to renew that extraterritorial permit every year. And shortly after the new Trudeau government, after Justin got in, he said, "You know, how about every 5 years? Let's make this a little easier." And now there's a half a dozen new ones opening up because they're realizing we just aren't having the level of fatalities that a lot of other people are having. And oddly enough, when you don't treat addicts like criminals, they eventually get help. You know, sitting across from a nurse as you deal with your particular demons, at some point, you'll ask for help. And they do.
Well, you know, we're going to get a lot of letters if we go down this road some more. But as long as we're talking about this, there was an amazing study I heard about. This is an NPR thing I heard about maybe a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up the stuff on the web, and it's absolutely true. In Sweden, they said, You know what? The only reason people are heroin dealers is that they don't have a freaking job anymore because they're heroin addicts.
Right.
And they need to make money somehow. And so I'm going to get this wrong. So, you know, don't This is not actual facts. Go look it up, please, please, everybody. But the notion was that if you're a heroin addict, you can go to the doctor and they will give you heroin right there in the doctor's office or whatever.
Yep.
And the first effect, of course, was that the dealers dried up.
Yeah, that business.
And so new addicts essentially went to almost zero. That's A. And B, all the addicts that were dying before because you do really stupid stuff when you shove your arm full of heroin, I'm told, stops happening. It's like, wow. It's, for me, as an economist, we're always fascinated by running the numbers and saying, oh, you know what? We can solve this problem by doing the complete opposite of what we thought we should do.
Of what we've been doing so far, yeah.
It was fascinating to hear about this. Really, really fascinating to hear about it. And I hope – now, here we're going a little crazy with the opioid addiction thing because there are people who are in chronic pain.
Yes.
And they're not addicts. You know, they take the one pill a day, but that's what keeps them going. And that's not addiction, but we're going to make them into addicts. And so it's
– well, again, it's, as you start knuckling down on treating this as a criminal enterprise or criminal activity – you make the situation worse, not better.
Well, you see, you were sounding pretty reasonable then, but then you went all socialist and Canadian on me. I'm sorry.
You know, the problem is I sound like an American until you talk about certain subjects. But, and I did, you know, announce you the way I wanted to because it literally was a little tweet storm that happened when your latest and arguably last email came out about the newsletter. And you said, this is it. I'm not going to send any more of these. You'll just find me on Twitter. And I was a few people who said, oh my goodness, you'll be back on Run As. It's like, oh yeah, he'll be back on Run As. That's inevitable. I knew that. You knew that. We just had to tell everybody else that. And then I finally just messaged you and like, we really should do that and just calm everybody down. It's going to be fine. You know, for those who don't understand, we are actually friends. Even when the microphones are not in front of us, it's hard to imagine. And we're going to have conversations one way or another. And if you'd like us to record them, we're happy to do so.
So I've gotten into a little trouble in the past by pointing at something new and saying, because, you know, new technologies have what I call the Rorschach phase. And let me give you a super simple example of that. Super simple. You were probably busy because you're a busier man than I at conferences. But at the first Ignite, this was what, in Chicago?
Yes.
Then Terry Myerson, the Windows guy, got up and he said, we have this new thing called Windows Update for Business. It's a cloud-based service. And we're like, collectively holding our breaths, you know, and months go by and then it goes into the Rorschach phase.
Right.
The Rorschach phase is we know exactly zero, except that it's a cloud-based service and it's got to do with updates.
Yeah.
And so we start imagining what it's going to be. Do I have to have an Azure ID to get into this? Do I have to have a Microsoft account? And we all just went on.
Yes.
We didn't say it was fact. Yeah, and then you know what it turned out to be? They took the Windows Update server and they made it about 3% different, you know, a little more than that. But basically, you can be using the Windows Update client, the regular one that your grandmother uses to get updates. But now there's a little more control and it's better with bandwidth stuff. But I mean, calling it a cloud-based service was just
a little bit of a stretch.
Now, that's a little example. Big example for our Rorschach technology are self-driving cars. Now, we've been hearing about self-driving cars since the beginning of time.
Oh, I mean, sure.
Somebody my age would have seen the Jetsons who had self-flying cars. That sort of thing, you know? So it's been this question, does this seem reasonable? And what's funny is that it's one of those technologies that's always sounded like it'll be here in 20 years. Or if you talked about stuff in the 70s or the 80s, we probably won't have that till the year 2000. I don't know what was going to happen in the year 2000.
Everything was going to happen in the year 2000.
Exactly. So self-driving cars have been, you know, maybe 20 years from now, for a very long time.
That's also very much like fusion, right? You just say it's forever from now.
I think fusion's always been next year.
Yep.
Because there's always the, how do we do the tokamak and all this other sort of stuff. And
oh, my favorite one is the Lockheed Martin, the high beta one, which has been 5 years away from delivery for about 5 years now.
I can't see that a fusion reactor is anything we should worry about in terms of details or safety or stuff because, you know, that's, you know, can't get in the way of progress. Well, self-driving cars have been like that, but all of a sudden, I've heard a few things. One, you probably know this. Anybody listening to this probably knows this, that apparently some of the Tesla cars have a self-driving thing, or they had it until somebody cracked down. And of course, Google's had those silly little capsule things that drive around.
They're so cute. Like a car, only way cuter.
Well, you know, if that were all it were, I mean, the beauty of one of those things is think how much you could just mess them up. Because if you lived in Northern California, parking is at a real premium there. And my brother's an engineer there. And his idea was he was going to mount a small cannon with ping pong balls in his car so that as the thing started to back in, it just needs a couple of ping pong balls. That's all it needs to see some motion. It's like, and it just runs away. And then you got the space.
Yeah.
Or
just frighten it off.
If you really don't want those people to come by, you just train your dogs to be friendly. And they just stand out in the road there and they sniff the car and the car's not smart enough to be able to. So the revenuevers have to bring snacks in order to get to the house or right. something along those lines. You know, but I'm hearing that it's a thing. It's a thing. And again, in the Rorschach phase, what's wonderful?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It'll all be
perfect.
You
got to go someplace. You just hop in the back seat and you can have that. That me time with your phone that we all want when we're driving, but that people have been yelling at about us
yes.
for quite a while. You know, you've had that third drink of wine. You know you can drive, but better to let the car do it or mm-hmm. something along those lines. Don't have legs. Can't drive at night because your eyes are old. You know, these are answers. Just absolutely great stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, the more I think about it, the more I think there's a lot of bad things could happen. First of all, I think there's going to be massive energy hogs. I think they will create some ecological nightmares. And worse, I believe they will create new digital divide or divides and source of yet another fragility. So let's look at these quickly, okay? So the first thing is that my understanding is all of these digital cars are electric. Is that right? I don't know of any gas-powered ones.
I mean, there's a few gas-powered ones out there, but it's degrees of automation, right? Like Volvo's been working on this stuff for a long time in terms of crash avoidance and a lot of the stuff you'd want for full automated driving. And but those are gas. And Mercedes-Benz actually has two semi-trailers, like diesel-powered tractor trailers, driving around the U.S. right now in the states where they're allowed. There's a driver in them, but otherwise they're automated. Just sort of putting on the miles to show that these things really work.
But they mostly work on a highway.
Well, yes. Well, she's in the end what you wanted from a long-haul truck anyway.
No questions about it. But I mean, you know, let's understand that the way we're going to solve these problems is by greatly – I'm going to sound technical now. I used to be like a technical guy. By controlling the domain in yes. which they work. But in reality, even then – you know, I mean, if you're driving on the highway right now, if the truckers are being pricks, it can be really bad. But
yeah.
typically they're not. Typically the truckers are under horrible pressures that didn't exist before those friggin' computers came around and before the GPS came around. So it's still considered to be a great job if you want to be your own boss.
Right.
And you know, they're helpful if they see that they're, because it doesn't take but three or four truckers to block an entire highway.
Sure.
Hold it to 55 miles an hour. But they see that and they aren't jerks. And so they move you out of the way.
Right. And I also love the idea, because they're limited to only drive 8 hours a day, that the fact that we would be able to use these trucks 24 hours a day, that's got to be a huge impact on transport. You know, just the utilization will go way, way up. It strikes me that should we actually get vehicles that are fully automated, especially in the semi-trailer class, and get legislation in place to allow it to happen, the cost of transport is going to drop like a rock because you get such high utilization out of these vehicles when you don't have to have a driver in them.
Okay, we're going to get to that, but two quick points on that. One, I didn't know this until I heard this on the Car Guys about a year ago, but you know, most engines are not built to have a 24-hour duty cycle.
True.
I could be wrong. And look, Mercedes makes great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if you ran your typical semi 24/7, I think it would crap out pretty quickly. But I could be wrong. And the second point is something you touch on. It's really important about the truckers. This is a stat that I heard from Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's not his stat. He got it from someplace where I trust him. 10% of U.S. jobs involve driving a vehicle.
Yes.
Wow.
It's one of the single largest job categories as a specific job category, just the long haul category alone. I recently read an Intel study that said 400 million people worldwide make their living shipping people or things.
Wow. You know, and again, okay, I'm a progress guy. I would not be, in 1890, I wouldn't be saying, let's not bring those horseless carriages in because I make buggy whips. You know,
that's right.
And of course, that's always our classic one is the buggy whips thing. But wow. You know, at least my economy and yours to a certain extent has been greatly affected by, first of all, the pipeline between China and North America has gotten a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. And there's really smart people in China who work for 1/10 of what your folks or my folks do. And so there's obviously going to be disruption. There are people that don't have jobs. That's one of the biggest reasons why we can't get rid of this recession.
Well, part of it, I think, also is the speed of this is going to happen. As I've been doing pieces around this idea of automated driving, I collected these two pictures from New York. One's from 1905, and all of the vehicles on the street are horse-drawn carriages, except for one. There's one horseless carriage out there. And then in 1915, it's all horseless carriages
yep.
and one horse.
Yes. It was basically 20 years from, hey, we made this work, to hey, it's everywhere.
And now we're talking 3 years? Like, there's just going to, you realize the moment that you have automated trucking and the cost drops so dramatically.
Those guys are all out of jobs.
The trucking company doesn't switch, they go out of business, and then you don't have jobs.
And by the way, that's a great point. Let's always get back to that is, you know, it's not just the businesses that are being jerks. It's that they have competition.
And if they don't do it,
if FedEx doesn't do it, if UPS doesn't do it, then others are going to come around. Uber. We'll do it. We'll
absolutely. Before we continue, and maybe it's against my wisest decisions, I do have to take a short commercial break.
Let's do that.
This episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by Policy Pack. Kill local admin rights on your Windows machines. Use Policy Pack to increase security and enable standard users to bypass UAC prompts when needed. Block malware, crypto locker, and similar software, and even unknown threats. Give standard users access to control panel applets or let them install their own applications. Policy Pack increases security by working alongside your group policy and SCCM or even non-domain joined machines with Policy Pack Cloud. Get serious about removing admin rights today. Check out Policy Pack on-prem and Policy Pack Cloud at policypack.com. And we're back with Mark Manassi, and we're talking about automated vehicles and all the things that entertain us in any given moment, because that's what Mark and I like to talk about. So welcome, sir. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. And you were on a path of a story.
So we talked a bit about, hey, if we're not careful about this, we're going to unemploy some good people.
Yes.
And on the one hand, you can't get in the way of progress. On the other hand, you probably heard the pitchforks guys, you know, and I think there's some real stuff to worry about that. But let's talk about one that nobody talks about.
Yes.
Self-driving cars tend to be electric cars.
Yes.
We would thus have many of them. And I'm going to go back to just getting out of graduate school in the late 70s, early 80s. And I was an economist, and I was in D.C. And the reason that I was an economist was that I not only knew the economics, I could also write computer programs. Mm-hmm. So I could build models and stuff like that. So I learned a lot of stuff. And in those days, if you were in D.C., the chances were good you'd get some energy jobs. And I did. I was fortunate to have some more interesting ones, but the energy jobs, and there were certain things everybody knew. If you had been on a job for more than 8 hours, you knew the following statistic. If you want to do something power-wise, and you're going to do something, burn it in an engine, burn it in a generator, whatever, that electricity was the worst way to do it. Because if you took an amount of gasoline that would take a car X miles, if you do that via electricity, you lose some of it in the transmission, in the burning and transmission of turbines and that sort of thing, and two-thirds of it. Between that and the transmission was two-thirds of it. So basically, dumping some – again, we don't use gasoline to create electric power, but you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Is that if you dump gasoline in a car and you have it go X miles, if you were to do instead dump that in a generator somewhere, transport it hundreds of miles across the country, and then stick it in an electric car, you're only getting one-third.
And there's two arguments here, obviously. One is you don't generate electricity that way. You generate a better way.
Whoa. Yeah. We could be putting natural gas cars out on the highway tomorrow.
True.
And by the way, and natural gas is where all the new burning is. So I'm sorry. Yeah. That's an oranges to oranges comparison.
I don't disagree. It's just that natural gas, pound for pound, isn't as dense as gasoline for energy. So it makes your vehicle heavier to carry enough natural gas to be able to go the distances you want to do, which undermines the value. So it actually makes more sense to burn natural gas at high efficiencies to generate electricity because of the way that it transports.
Wait. You're saying there'll be inefficiencies because the fuel tank is a little heavier, and so we should instead have a place to burn it in the middle of somewhere? You're really going to argue that when you do all the math on it, and I've done it. I mean, I used to do it for a living. I mean, you know, when you do all the math on it, then you are definitely, once you go from the hydrocarbon to the electricity, you're losing a sane amount just in transmission.
You, without a doubt, you are, right? And so you have to localize how you generate electricity. There are lots of different ways to make it. I happen to live in British Columbia, where virtually all of our power comes from hydroelectric. So I'm looking at power differently than, say, on the East Coast of the United States. But they think the more salient point here, when you talk about the advantage of electric cars, is the simplification of the car. So, and I'm going from the Stanford study that was recently released around this. It says your standard drivetrain for an internal combustion engine represents about 2,000 parts. And obviously, with the maintenance and so forth needed, you get an average lifespan of about 250,000 kilometers. And then you compare that to an electric drivetrain with 20 parts. That's two orders of magnitude less.
I'm not arguing the point.
Right. And projecting a lifespan of 800,000 kilometers. And they are projecting that lifespan because it takes a long time to drive 800,000 kilometers. And that's still an average. They're going to be more. So from a vehicle efficiency point of view and reliability point of view, especially when you think about this from a service model, so not individually owned cars where it's a lifestyle thing, it's just the pure mechanical reliability, these are better machines.
as long as we're not losing too much in the transmission. No, I don't have a problem with electric car. And by the way, if electric cars weren't crazy for two reasons, I'd have one. I mean, one of the things that's annoyed me most in the last couple of years is that we have this thing, and I don't know if it's national, I think it may be federal, where electric cars have to make noise because people are too stupid to look after their kids and crossing the roads.
Yes. Well, they're very spooky quiet.
They are fantastic quiet. I mean, yeah. Come on. You know, when I was a kid, living in a city meant living with air you could almost not see through.
Right.
But, you know, then we let people in Asia do all of our manufacturing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We really appreciate it. And so the only thing putting junk into the air was cars. Mm-hmm. When I moved to DC in 1980, then DC had a pollution problem and no manufacturing whatsoever. It was just that the cars were so terrible.
Yes.
But they've gotten better. They don't produce as much junk, you know?
No, the requirements that the governments have put on them to decrease their emissions and increase their efficiency is more than doubled the yield of a barrel of oil in 30 years.
Absolutely. Oh, no. It's fantastic stuff. And I wish my country would continue that, but we'll just see if that ever happens.
Well, you have states stepping up when the federals are stepping down.
And you know, I know we're all supposed to be all upset about how Trump pulled us out of Paris. I love the reaction. I love the reaction because, you know, we do have a 10th Amendment that says the states' rights are more important than the federal rights.
Right.
It's been ignored since the Civil War. But I love to see this. I mean, I love to see the idea that there's – because, I mean, it happened a long time ago, right? California was the first state in our country that just said, you know what? Those emission standards are stupid.
Right.
if you want to drive those things in this state, they have to be better. And so by doing the right thing and pushing us in the right direction.
And from a manufacturing point of view, you might as well manufacture to the strictest standard because it doesn't make sense to manufacture more than one kind of car.
Exactly. Exactly. No, it's worked out extremely well, and I'm hoping that we will continue to see that.
Yeah, my favorable argument in this would be the upside to controversy is awareness. And so I think far more people are aware of the Paris Accords and a number of other aspects of what's going on with the federal government right now and making more informed decisions about it.
Well, and until the next good story comes along.
Well, there's always something.
While we're talking about manufacture of cars, let's talk about another problem. Electric cars have batteries.
They do.
Batteries have really nasty stuff in them. And the smartest electric car company I know of, the Tesla guys, they say that they are going to recycle their batteries, 60% of the batteries.
Right.
Now, I don't know whether that means the nickel gets dumped into the water system or the cadmium gets dumped into the water system. And no, those aren't the actual things. But there's plenty of stuff in there that we have a problem now that we just do not handle batteries right. In theory, you can take some places. I mean, I take the time to do it. When I get rid of a laptop, the laptop gets thrown away and the battery goes to some recycling station. And even then, I've heard that many of the recycling stations don't actually recycle. So it's a little frustrating. The idea that this is going to happen with all of our cars gives me some worries, you know? Another thing about electric cars, slow refills.
Yep.
Now, you know, the people that don't have electric cars, it pretty much takes about 5 hours to power the car. Most of these cars give you under 200 miles for the trip. Now, the really good guys, you know, Tesla, they say you go like 300 miles. That takes 5 hours at the regular station. You know, I just checked that on the Tesla site before we got on here. The Tesla site said 1 hour at a supercharged station, and it gets you 300 miles on the best performing electric car now. Now, in contrast, it takes me 10 minutes to put 600 miles worth of diesel into my tank.
True.
So that's maybe my perspective is incorrect in that I use my car for two things, either to make very short trips to the grocery store or to go drive 6 hours to do a class or something like that. For the grocery store, definitely good. But for the 6 hour trip, that would be, you know, although who knows, maybe it'll mean the return of the tea room, a place where you go and you.
Well, if you've been to a supercharging station, that's exactly what they are. That's exactly what they are.
But Richard, I would have had to spend $100,000 for an interesting $30,000 car that happens to have an electric engine. So I wouldn't have any money for vacation.
You know what's funny is in Europe, like on the Autobahn, it's the same thing. The fill-up stations have lovely coffee shops with good internet in them. Like, you're supposed to take a break. And I've got friends who are Tesla drivers who have driven up from California to visit me here, and their favorite part is the stop for recharge. And that's when they have their meal, that's when they do their email. Like, that's just part of the process. But yeah, it's a half hour stop most of the time, and it gets them up to the next recharge station, you know, 3-4 hours later. So it I agree with you as old school drivers where it's like, I want to burn through this tank. It made, the gas had the range. But I'll tell you, driving on the Autobahn at 260 kilometers an hour, you mow down a tank in an hour and a half. Air friction should be what it is. And then you stop at one of these facilities and charge and fill up again.
Well, with respect, Richard, again, to join that club, you spent $100,000 on a car. Okay. Yeah. So really what you're telling me is, hey, Mark, it's 1962 and I love flying. My God, you can't believe it. You get on there. They're handing you drinks. You get a pack of smokes. I mean, there's a pretty woman handing stuff out and they fire her ass when she's 33 because she's too old to be a stewardess anymore. This is just awesome. Somehow reality creeps in at some point. And when everybody's got an electric car, I don't think it's going to be like that.
It's going to be interesting to see what that's like, but I don't think people are going to buy these cars. When we go over to this mobility as a service model, it makes no sense for individuals to own cars. You will simply call it up on your phone and take the vehicle you need.
So my next point, these things are driven by software.
Yes.
Should we trust the software?
Yeah, I think we should, because we sure as heck don't trust the people.
You know, we could say that, but we've done good things, and we've held the death rate at 50,000 a year for a very long time by, you know, taking this and that and the other ways of dying out of a car. And pretty soon, I'm guessing we'll have cell phones that know when you're driving and they won't work or something like that. And that'll probably bring 20,000 people back to life. So that won't be a bad thing necessarily.
Again, taking the current numbers for the OECD, so these are the sort of Western world, it's 1.2 million people per year killed. And that half of emergency room admissions are for car accidents.
Well, it's only half because it's only in America that you can get guns. Now, if we had guns in all of the OECD, then that would be a whole different number.
But one of the interesting parts with this particular study that I'm reading is they're saying the vast majority of organ donors come from car accidents. So what is the organ donor process going to look like if we eliminate the vast majority of car accidents by going to automated vehicles?
That is certainly a concern, but I think the bigger concern is, what are the states, the counties, and the cities going to do when they don't have those massive fines for drunk driving?
Yeah, or speeding. You know, like, what happens when all that business goes away? On the other hand, you're spending a lot less on roads because you're densifying traffic, because I think car sharing is pretty much going to be the default when you don't own the car.
Absolutely, which leads to that interesting question. I've got to get to work.
Yes.
So doesn't that mean that when I call the Uber, it's not going to take me from the suburb to the city until all six seats are full?
I don't think it'll be that precise. I think it would at least, but all you have to do is go to two, and the room on the road jumps up dramatically.
I'm not arguing that at the point, but I'm saying from the point of view of their revenue model.
Yeah.
I mean, Uber's not a government agency. They don't care about whether the world's getting better or not, unless you think the local government. Because let's be very clear. Yes, I agree with you that if you're going to do this, first of all, as far as I can see, electric cars are really good for inside cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they really make good vehicles to drive from San Diego to British Columbia. That doesn't seem – I mean, it could be done.
Yeah, it's hard to do. But I do feel like as soon as the driving is automated, you don't care that you live in a further suburb because you're already at work. You're already online. You're doing your thing. You don't have to put your attention into driving. I think our suburbs are going to expand as automated driving takes over.
Well, there's a point you're missing there, and that's the infrastructure. You talk to the Google guys, and the way that they say an important linchpin for the Google self-drive and all the other things is that, you know, we can try to make our cars smart, and we've done some great stuff. You mentioned the Mercedes stuff. This is like, I don't know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago on Top Gear, they took out a Jaguar and they're driving somewhere. They've got it on cruise control and they locked on the truck in front of them that was 15 car lengths ahead of them or something like that. They're pretty much done at that point. Now, that's a technology that's in a significant number of cars now. Mm-hmm. I mean, good Lord, the thing that kept people my age from getting driver's license when I was a kid was being able to parallel park. Well, your Prius will do it for you.
Yes.
Those are great things. Again, very limited things. And they assume there's a certain level of continuity. There aren't big surprises. But the Google guys freely say that in order for this to really work, they need sensors everywhere. Not only that, gravel roads don't work so good because they don't have a line in the middle they can see. There was an article in the Detroit Free Press yesterday that said that many cities are going to have to repaint the lines in the middle of their roads because the contrast is not high enough for auto-driving cars. What that means is, like, for example, I live in a town where some of the places can't get internet. That's kind of scary, you know? Is there a chance they're going to have self-driving cars? Self-driving cars are going to essentially need the internet. I'm sure they can live without it for a while. But they've got to pick up information about the things around them and exactly where they are and things that, all that sort of stuff. And if you're not in a very tech-supplied place, mm-hmm. I think we end up with another digital divide.
I think you're right.
I mean, if not all of my town can even get to the internet, then where will we get the money to paint things and put sensors up and stuff like that so that we could have auto-drive cars? And this is a town that's not particularly rich, and there is a lot of drunk driving and that sort of thing. And this is the kind of town where investing the money would probably be a terrific thing. But it's not going to happen for 40 years.
I think you're just projecting too large numbers and also not thinking through the possible business models. Like, I think about a large car manufacturer that's providing automated cars turning to that town and saying, look, we'll provide the vehicles. We'll even help fix up some of your infrastructure. You get rid of your taxis and your buses, and we'll pay you a cut of everything that's made from this.
Not for a town of 980 people.
No. No, I'm with you, but you know, you're talking about that scales down actually pretty well. I mean, 980 people, you're talking two cars, four cars, like that's very few when the automation takes control. But yeah.
At like 8 a.m., a lot of them have to go to jobs.
Right? Well, out of 980 people, how many do you think are driving to a job that is walking distance?
Oh, this is America. You can't walk to places in America. Come on, man.
You've described an itty-bitty little village, my friend. Like, where are they going?
Well, it's actually quite large from a miles point of view, but it is semi-rural and that sort of thing. And also, this is Florida, which means we have big hunks of land that you can't do anything with. So you just kind of drive around it.
I do think the large-scale business models around this, you know, we've got socialized car insurance here in British Columbia. And one of the side effects of that was that it became more economically viable for the insurer to repair the worst intersections than it is to demand the city do it, because it just reduced the overall cost of accidents by having better left-hand turn lanes and dividers and just eliminate those key accident points. And the cost savings actually net beneficial to the insurance company.
Actually, we don't have that. As you know, we have private and massively expensive car insurance. And what's fascinating is those guys are screwed no matter what. Mm. Because when self-driving cars come in, you essentially don't need insurance. I didn't do anything. I just got in the car. Sue the guy who sold me the car.
And if you're talking about the big companies providing all the vehicles anyway, they will self-insure. That's all the only thing that actually makes sense. It's only going to get interesting when somebody finally is seriously injured or killed by an automated vehicle. And we know there's no substitute for understanding the legalities of something than to try the case.
And that's the bad part. That's the bad part of it. I'm certain that everybody listening, and if they haven't seen this, if you Google wired Jeep Cherokee hacked.
Yes, that was awesome.
It wasn't awesome. It was. The poor bastards had their car frozen up in the middle of a California highway, and there wasn't any shoulder. The idea was that there was a Jeep that was an internet-connected Jeep, and some white hat hackers were hired to try to take the thing down. And they didn't know exactly about where the guy was going, so they took control of stuff like his windshield wipers, which was annoying, and they took more stuff, and finally they just turned the car off in the middle of the highway.
Yeah.
And I guess they thought he had a shoulder, but there wasn't any shoulder. Yeah. And so we didn't have our first self-driving car death.
No, not there. But, you know, and the story is great from the perspective of, you see exactly how this happened.
Yeah.
Chrysler subbed out, or Jeep, the entertainment system, knowing the customers wanted Spotify and Google Maps and so forth. And then because it required a big screen, later on, the car people are like, well, let's just use the screen for the OCD data so that you can actually, you know, communicate with the car. The entertainment folks weren't worried about security because, hey, it's just entertainment, not knowing the car folks were going to put their stuff into it as well. And admittedly, those white hats, it took them a year to hack that app successfully and do the replacement, find the exploit, update the new firmware and so forth. But once it's done, it's done. Needless to say, I suspect it's fixed now. But it does, you know what you haven't seen in the 100,000 or so Teslas are driving around that take updates several times a year? Where's the Tesla exploit? Like that should have been done by now, don't you think?
No, there aren't that many Teslas, first of all.
Yeah.
If you wanted to buy one of the Prestige models, they only sold 1,000 and they disappeared in about an hour. It's still rich people that are buying this. Normal folks are not, you know, and when I say rich people, you got to have a lot of money to throw 100,000 or 120,000 at a car that you're not going to get for a year and a half and all that stuff. But you mentioned an important point. All self-driving cars will be software driven, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. They will be almost certainly internet connected all the time. And so what do we do about Patch Tuesday?
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to use Windows as an example. Everybody likes to mock Microsoft. The reason they're mocking Microsoft is they are the biggest. And in terms of people actually using their stuff on a computer, you know, something with a keyboard rather than a phone or a tablet or something, Microsoft's got everybody beat. So when they screw up, it's obvious.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also the black hats target the best impact, right? They're going to go after the successful.
Most bang for the buck. Sure. Absolutely. You know? But I'm saying, you and I could go on about SMB1 at great length, and yet we needed WannaCry to get rid of the thing. But remember, everyone forgets, you know, all the security guys wag their fingers at those stupid users that didn't put that patch in. And my answer to them is, have you forgotten that a year ago, you guys released a Windows 7 patch that blew out Bluetooth? Yeah. And at that point, people laugh and say, oh, well, much more important, losing your data or losing your Bluetooth. Well, that's the point. I don't know before I install it, you moron. And I don't, you know, I'm an SMB shop, maybe. Maybe I've got 400 employees. I got two IT guys. They don't have time to test everything immediately.
And we can't just trust you because you do break things even up until today. Just double checking the numbers. There are a couple of 100,000 Tesla S's in the world today. From an overall number of cars perspective, that's not that many cars, but it's not none. And certainly you'd think they would that there's got to be somebody hacking away at it. And my point would be, you can make secure software. You just have to choose to upfront.
Now, wait a minute. If I want to become a PC hacker, all I got to do is buy a PC and a copy of Windows.
Yep.
My investment's not great. I'm sure there's bad guys out there that are trying to do this. And of course, the instrumentation to be able to, I mean, you can't get a command prompt off your Tesla, I assume, and start, you know, reading what it's doing. You don't have any knowledge of all of what its updates do and et cetera. But these things are going to work. The software is going to work because it'll be a collaboration of a lot of people, which can either be a good thing or a bad thing. Obviously, we're going to have software. The thing that I would like to see, I would like very much for the software that is running these self-driving cars to be open source, not in the sense of you and I can check in and update, but I want to be able to look at it.
Sure.
Am I going to? No. But if there's enough eyeballs.
No, you want the Krebs and the Steve Gibsons of the world looking at that code and going, are you crazy?
I want somebody to get a PhD in computer science by deconstructing what's wrong with the process and how it could get better and all that sort of stuff. And that's something that I'd really, really, really like to see. But I mean, basically, when you think about it, and you made exactly the right point I was going to make, is that you're not going to buy a self-driving car. Mm-hmm. You'll buy cars that are smarter and smarter and smarter, but you're not going to buy a self-driving car. You're just going to Uber it. And maybe it's not Uber. I mean, how's that going to work? One is maybe your local government runs it. That's entirely possible. Maybe it's an Uber or a Lyft or somebody. Now, how do we do it in this country? Well, let's see. When it comes to cell providers, we decided that local monopolies were a bad idea. So we created a rule under Bill Clinton's regime that we should have two monopolists that share this stuff. You and I know that when we get off the plane to Barcelona and we turn the phone on, there's like eight providers we can choose from.
Yes.
We don't have that in the States. It's like there's two and that's it. Thank you very much. Unless you want to go to Walmart and buy Straight Talk, and all that is AT&T sloppy seconds, you know. So that's not really a service. And then, well, how do we do healthcare? Well, we've ended up having special monopolies with that, too. If you live anywhere, the chances are good in 50 miles. It's all the same people, same logo, you know, different buildings. That would be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we do that with power, and we do that with cable as well. And there's always kind of the argument, but not really, because we've got so much shared infrastructure in the place that we needn't do it. But what keeps that from happening? And the whole thing is, essentially, a self-driving car is a cloud service.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big cloud on top of it. There's lots of software. They get your credit card before you even get in there. And does it mean that when I sit down and sit my butt down in the seat that I've just agreed to some software license?
Essentially, yes.
Well, we have to stop doing that. No, I don't know if you read my software conspiracy book back in 99.
I did.
But one of the things that I said is that one of the creepy things about software is this notion that you have to sign an agreement whether you like it or not, and there's no negotiating it.
Right.
But you know who showed them the way? The airlines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When you sit in an airline seat, you essentially, you're not a citizen of any country.
Yep.
You have no rights whatsoever, et cetera. And we've just been sitting there lapping it up and saying, please, sir, may I have another? And that's how the software business got to where it is. And I would hate for the simple process of getting in a car and going to the grocery store, meaning all of a sudden I'm no longer a citizen of the United States, I no longer have rights, et cetera.
On the other hand, the upside of the way that the airlines did the legality was that every incident, every error was no fault, completely public, And we learned from it and made the safest transportation system in the world. Wouldn't you want that for automated vehicles?
If somebody grabs me up, drags me out of an automated vehicle and beats me up, then no, I don't think so. I mean, would you argue that you look forward to getting on a plane?
No, but that's not the aircraft. That's the airline. And that's really North American airlines. You know, there are better airlines out there, but this is an issue of how we've decided to secure these things and the theater that is around that. But you can't argue with the airline safety record that getting rid of the lawsuits around airlines and focusing on safety by being open and transparent about stuff has succeeded. It's incredibly safe, far safer than driving. And I would want that same process in place for these new vehicles.
Safer, perhaps, but not as comfortable, and with fewer options. I mean, am I going to have to be a gold driver to get a seat that fits my ass? I mean, you know, it's just
it's going to be. And so, what if you do? Right, go be a gold driver. Like they, I'm sure there's going to be perks in that. But I think the mobility as a service represents a huge. Literally a next stage in evolution for civilization, bigger than the original car itself. And that opportunity is going to unlock a lot of possibilities. And I'd hate to have it held back because we couldn't figure out the security and safety aspects.
Well, we haven't figured out the security and safety aspects. In the example that you give, the airlines, you know that it's mostly theater, as you just said. It's nonsense. I'm supposedly the citizen of a free country.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, my Constitution's got a Fourth Amendment, you know, unreasonable search and seizure. Yeah. The fact that I'm going to get on an airplane isn't probable cause, but we live with it.
Yeah.
But, we don't – most humans don't have to do that, though. Most people aren't like you and me. We don't voluntarily get onto an airline more than, you know, twice a year or something like that.
Well, and you and I get harassed far less at the airports because we do it so often. There is – a greater pig mode, right? TSA pre, like they're just not interested in us because we fly all the time. It's like, if you were going to do something dumb, you would have by now.
To an extent, but consider also, how do we make that transition? I know that you think it'll happen quickly, but phase one is going to be a city or cities.
Yeah. And probably San Francisco.
San Francisco is, yeah, that's a great first example. I wouldn't be surprised if Vancouver wasn't one or Toronto. I mean, look, there are cities. The three I'm going to pull out in North America where people just don't own cars because they're crazy to do it are going to be New York, San Francisco, Toronto, LA, I guess, to a certain extent. Seattleites would adopt it more quickly than they need to because they're greenier.
Yes.
You know?
As long as you can cast it in that light, yes.
Oh, well, no, that's obviously a greenier thing to do. I mean, the other problem with electricity that we didn't really get to is that electric cars really mean that there's still pollution, but it's someplace else.
Yep.
It's basically city people saying to rural people, suck our pollution.
Yeah, you do it. On the other hand, it's easier to control a mitt full of power plants compared to millions of cars.
No questions about that. No questions about that. But does it happen?
In countries where your regulations are actually enforced and modeled, yeah. But not all countries have that figured out.
Well, and again, as you said, you guys are lucky, and thank heavens for it, because in the Northeast, if we didn't have Hydro-Quebec, I don't know how they'd keep electricity coming to New York City and that sort of thing. But I mean, so I think the transition is the important thing. I hate to see a world where the getting from point A to point B problem is solved for the people in the 100 largest cities of the 19,200 cities in the United States.
Yes.
More of the digital divide, you know. If you – I'm going to be an old guy now and tell the youngsters in the crowd that when I was a kid – clunks at somebody in the next city cost more than it should because so-called long distance was deliberately overcharged so that the phone companies would have enough money to put just a phone in everybody's house. So, some old lady who's never going to call anywhere but the police or something like that, or her son down the street, could afford that. They called it UTS, Uniform Telephone Service.
Yes. But that was a government regulation put in place so that you would reduce the amount of have-not scenarios.
Precisely. Precisely. And I have been writing about this for the last literally 20 years, that we haven't done that with the internet. It's like, I know you're not going to disagree with me about this, but some of this crowd might. So let me just say this. I don't see how you could be a citizen of the United States if you don't have internet.
True.
And I'm not talking about a crappy little phone where you have to text to do things. I think basic internet service is something that we should be able to provide to everyone. If we can provide them electricity, why can't we piggyback the friggin' internet on it?
Well, and you got the United Nations standing up. I mean, that's back in 2011 saying that right to access internet. It's got to be an essential human right because it's that powerful, because it is the best kind of available education, that it's essential to making, to evolving mankind. If we're going to do this mobility as a service, if you're going to get the right to be the vehicle and transportation supplier for a San Francisco, that you also are required to support these smaller locales that may not be as easy or as profitable, or we will end up in a have-not scenario that is ultimately unacceptable.
Well, we talked about that back in the early 80s when long distance became deregulated, mm-hmm. and people like MCI came around. And here was the first time we saw this problem. MCI would say, sure, we'd love to be your provider if you live in Chicago, yeah. San Francisco, New York, something like that. Oh, you're in Kings County? I don't think so, you know. I mean, they called it cherry picking. And I've been really, really sad that we're not there yet. The fact that nobody has got the stones in the government to say, come on, this isn't hard. This really isn't hard. We really do have wires into everybody's house.
Yes, we've already done it.
Yeah, and then some. I mean, we've probably got fiber 90 feet from their house, for God's sakes, you know? These are doable things. And because I think if we have a thing whereby if you're on Medicaid-ish kind of stuff, you can get a cell phone. You get a cell phone free, and I don't know how many minutes you get, but it's not many. It strikes me that if you put a gun to my head and said, you can only have internet and not good internet, or you could have cell phone and not good cell phone, I would mm-hmm. say internet. So this is my point, is that you're agreeing with me that these things all have to come together. And I'm going to come back to saying, I'm sorry, but we don't do stuff like that here anymore. it really doesn't matter. I'm not being political. Well, I mean, I am in the big sense, but I mean, it doesn't matter who's in the Congress, doesn't matter who's in the White House. There really isn't any drive. There isn't a notion. There isn't an understanding that one of the reasons that we worked for the longest time is that when we built that highway, that expensive one across the America, anybody could get on the highway.
Yes.
And when we put those phones in, everybody gets a phone.
Yeah.
But the internet has left people behind. And it just strikes me, I hate to sound like a nut bar, but I mean, I think we need to fix the internet before we try to do something that relies upon it. Otherwise, we just make the digital divide wider. And we have been running on and running on, Richard. My God.
I wasn't going to stop you, my friend. That's just the way it is. And I don't. And then for the most part, we agree on these things. But I would point out, once upon a time, the United States did this better than anybody else in the world. And I think you can remember how. You just have to choose to. And we have to insist that it comes true again.
Could be.
I'm more optimistic than you are, my friend. But, you know, that's the 10 years difference between you, because you're turning 60, I'm turning 50. We're both
turning 50. 50. My God.
Yes. What's up with that?
Well, you know, it just, my experience has been that it just happens when you don't pay attention to it. Yeah. You know what's interesting, though, is that we economists talk about, I really can't call myself an economist anymore, but I got the training, you know, I did it for a while. We talk about something called money illusion. And money illusion is that let's assume we live in a world with a little bit of inflation. Like, we've had inflation of about 2-3% a year ever since we kicked that Jimmy Carter guy out of the White House.
Right.
So what that means is, if you are 70 years old now and, you know, you think about what a Mars bar cost when you were a kid, assuming there were Mars bars then, and you think about it now, and by the way, I don't buy candy, so I have no idea what this is. I'm going to throw a number out. Maybe it's $2, you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe in 1955, it was 2 cents. The front part of your brain can do math, and it understands that there's been this much inflation from point A to point B.
Right.
But when you see it, your tummy goes, oh, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, I had a place on the water in North Carolina, built it 20 years ago, and I sold it so I have money to retire. And when I look at what that thing went for, there's no way I could have purchased it.
Right.
You know, even though I know it didn't rise tremendously. The same thing happens with age. Mm-hmm. Because when you were a kid, you got a model in your head of what 50 means.
Yeah.
50 means the last 10 years before the heart attacks start. It's you're winding up last years before you get the gold watch and that sort of thing. But of course, that's absolutely not true.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the tables, you know, in that level, you are many years younger than that. And I look forward to... You keep it that way, because I look forward to playing with you many years in the future.
I have every intent. Mark Manassi, off the rails as always, my friend, but very enjoyable conversation.
I did too. Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.